Hello, and welcome to Twist and Sprout, a podcast brought to you by the folks at Bazaaran Community Farm, located in St. Just, West Cornwall. I'm your host, Carl Group, and as always, I'm glad to have you here. Episode 3, entitled Go Wild, Planting Wildflowers to Encourage Biodiversity, is a discussion on the results of the choices we make when filling our gardens with plants or the lawns we like to keep cut short. If we think of them as a supermarket, the nutritional value and regional specificity of foods we stock will either encourage and support the development of a diverse range of insects and invertebrates, or not. The episode is split into two parts. First, speaking with Nick Hall, who leads the wildflower project out at the farm, and then the National Trust's Ash Pearson, who will elaborate on how the products they purchase from the farm are used for their own unique project. We also get an impromptu visit from one of Nick's team, who has grown her own wildflower garden in just a year, and her enthusiasm for diving in to do it is electric. The interviews are out in the field, so expect some background noises like birds and bees, the local plane flying over to the Isles of Scilly, students on an educational walk at the farm, and a mountain bike coming down a steep rocky slope using very noisy brakes. Ash and I spoke unsheltered from the 40-kilometer-hour winds gusting off the Atlantic at Cape Cornwall, but I'm glad to say the equipment survived. If I sound a bit tired for the first couple of minutes speaking with Nick, I was coming off an adrenaline rush as I had just lost my wallet and was in a panic. I needed to meet Nick and was still spinning a bit with flight or fright chemicals running through my body. I do switch it up a gear and the rest of the interview does take off, and I'm glad to say I did find my wallet. Now, let's enter the garden where Nick works and listen to him outline the importance of wildflowers on biodiversity. Hello everyone, I'm here with Nick Hall out on the Bazaaran Community Farm, talking to him about his Bazaaran Community Farm wildlife or wildflower project. Sorry about that. So the Bazaaran Community Farm wildflower project. Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. Nick, nice to meet you after all this time. I've listened to some of your podcasts.
Terrific. What we skipped over, I like to ask at the beginning, is your favorite vegetable and how do you cook it?
Carrot. And I cut it up into two or three huge chunks and boil it or roast it.
So keeping it really simple.
Yes, yes.
Terrific and tasty. Nick, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and perhaps the wildflower project here?
Well, I'm a retired gentleman with Parkinson's, amongst other things, and I have a horticultural background. And Ian used to run a wild bee nectar pollinating kind of project here some years ago, and it was quite popular with people that couldn't always do the heavy physical farm work, particularly. And he actually asked me and some of the farm board asked me if I would step in, because it was felt that it would, when he left, it wouldn't survive. So we got some funding for the first year from the what was called the PLP, the Penwith Landscape Partnership, which is now folded as well. So we're flying with no hands now. We're self-funding, and we're basically all about the insects, right. Although we call ourselves a flower project, and don't tell anybody with this, but we got a couple of mottos. One is
so you want this edited out?
No, it's fine. One of the mottos is every insect counts, every bee counts, and the other one, of course, is borrowed from the Wilder People, the fantastic film, if you've ever seen that, which is No Insect Left Behind.
Right.
So I think we've got to the stage with the situation with the climate and so on, that really every insect does count. You know, it really is down to individual colonies, and that's where the National Trust came in, of course.
I'd like to cover that a little later, but a question I'd like to come back to is, do you feel that there's a sense of panic right now, or management, or where do you see when you say every insect counts or leave no insect behind? Where does that come from? And sense of an emotional background.
My response to that is really that people spend a lot of time watching the TV and talking about climate change and so on and biodiversity loss. And that does induce, if not panic, certainly stress and a lot of unhappiness. Whereas if you can do one practical thing, even if it's a very, very, very small thing, it's a whole ball game different than sitting there stewing in your worry and so on. And the one practical thing that people can do is plant a wildflower in their garden. And that's really the philosophy behind the project. You know, if we can get people with a disused corner of their gardens or something, just to increase the biodiversity slightly, and particularly in terms of plants that are part of the jigsaw of the ecology. One of the things I've done recently is I was working with the PLP and Nick Taylor and other people.
The PLP, just for people who may not know.
Yeah, the Penwith Landscape Partnership, which is now defunct.
Right, you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and we were doing ecological surveying in a lot of the fields and environments around West Penwith. And I was amazed by every little insect has other insects living on it, and every little flower has a particular insect that particularly likes that flower for a home. So it really is down to the fine detail. It's like a rainforest, even in your back garden. Or it would be if you had a biodiverse range of wildflowers instead of non-productive garden flowers that have been evolved to grow elsewhere and so on, and don't necessarily produce pollen and nectar that's useful for our own insects. And of course that whole pattern, that whole jigsaw is changing rapidly with climate change. So I mean, I don't know if it's the right place to say, but for instance, one of the things that we grow is the Argentinian Verbena bonariensis, which is a very tall, dark purple flowers, and a lot of the insects locally love it, and it's self-seeds, but it's not particularly invasive, but it's also the favourite plant of the hummingbird hawk moths, and they're coming over here from Italy, and they've started overwintering in the south of England. So some of our species, insect species, are all moving north as the temperature rises a little bit. And we're getting new species coming in, and we need to maintain the biodiversity, which is historically what's always happened, without necessarily labelling some plants as native and only growing them. So, you know, we've got a very big book which tells us all about distribution, and it's the scientific literature that doesn't really use the word native for plants. So wildflowers is probably a better word than native plants.
Do you know when the use of native came about?
Well, I guess it's a kind of colonial thing, isn't it? You know, it's a bit like, it's weird how it kind of reflects the sort of our attitude to native and immigrant, and to some degree, perhaps. Although that's a big topic that I wouldn't really want to go into.
Right. Okay, so where we are, do you mind describing sort of what's going on, where we're standing, what sort of workflow or planting flow, if you call it that?
Well, this is sets of staging, it's called, outside the main polytunnel, because it gets much too hot in the polytunnel in summer to grow things. So the first bit of staging, that's the tree nursery, which is a different subset of Basavan Community Farm. We're financially quite linked but quite separate as well. We're self-funding, as I said, in the wildflower project, but we do contribute to the farm financially, and we're kind of part of the farm now, so they've been very hospitable. So we've got three more sets of staging. We've got two of them at the moment, and we move plants here in the spring after they've germinated in the polytunnel.
Okay.
And grow them on so that it's not too hot for them, and they get hardened off a bit, and we don't have to water them so much.
And these are for sale then?
Yes, and we've got a little shop, a little wheelbarrow by the shop. I mean, we don't make massive amounts of money out of them because we're trying to encourage people locally to grow wildflowers more in order to increase and maintain biodiversity. You know, we'd like to see that. So we tend to sell them for £1.50 as a suggested donation, which is whatever people can afford. And the plants come into kind of peak condition at different times. So this is purple loosestrife, which grows locally in a couple of patches near Gurner's Head. And it's a massive flower spike, which is just developing there. You can just see it's coming up. And that'll all come into flower, and every bee within about 50 yards will home in on that little patch of purple loosestrife.
Really? Wow.
And it likes damp conditions. We've got a bit of evening primrose just because it was easy to get the seed. And these are plug trays, which is what the National Trust ask for. And we grew for them last year and again this year. And they're a bit of a different story, because what we grow in the pots is wildflowers that are part of the ecological jigsaw, but they're also attractive. And we believe that mental health is linked to being surrounded by beautiful things and growing beautiful plants. And the two things are not exclusive. You can have an attractive plant, an attractive garden, and also contribute to the ecological jigsaw and be part of that network. So there are plenty of examples of plants which are both beautiful and ecologically supportive. There's some Viper's bugloss at the front of the polytunnel, which is spectacular at the moment. They've got a flower spike maybe 2 foot high, mm-hmm. covered in blue flowers, which look like little viper's heads.
Right.
And the bees just love it. Mm. But it's not just bees that we're catering for. And the bees that we are interested in, of course, are wild bees, not honeybees. We're not, as the Wildflower Project, interested in honeybees.
The terminology of wildflowers and then, I guess, traditional garden flowers, and then honeybees and wild bees, do you think that that's something that the general public needs to know more about? Because if people are going to buy things at a normal garden center, they're thinking that they are contributing, I would think, to the ecological sort of and the biodiversity that you're talking about. But when I hear you speak, it sounds like there is a difference between the two.
Yeah, well, I'd echo Ash's talk on your other podcast where he was talking about leguminous plants, these vetches and so on, meadow vetchling, tufted vetch. They have particular proteins in them that the longhorn bee needs. That's how closely knit species are to their food plants. And we're all familiar with butterflies and caterpillars having a particular food plant. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you know, the marsh fritillary is an extinct butterfly that's been reintroduced in Devon, and there's maybe one day will be reintroduced down West Cornwall. Who knows? Its caterpillar, I believe, only eats devil's bit scabious.
Right.
So that's a difficult plant to germinate.
What makes it difficult to germinate?
Okay, in the simple terms, the seed viability has a window of maybe a few weeks, I think.
Okay.
If you grow seed that's 8 weeks, just fallen off the plant, you get 80% germination. If you grow seeds from a seed merchant that's a year old, that's been in a paper packet for the winter, maybe 8% germination.
Really?
Yeah. So I was told those figures by a wildflower seed gathering expert, whose name I don't remember, last year. So.
And does that get, if you've got seeds that, I don't know if there's a best before or use by on a seed packet.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, so would you say that, so a year on, you're saying 8%?
Yeah, less than a year on. And I think the problem is particularly true of devil's bit scabious, but I think the problem for wildflowers is they often grow in marginal places because they don't compete with coarse growing grasses and so on in those places, and they don't have a lot of energy, a lot of protein, a lot of nitrogen to spare, so they can't pack their seeds with sandwich boxes with a lot of cheese sandwiches. They basically, the seed gets dropped and it's on its own,
right,
and it has to cope with a very small supply pack.
Okay.
So the window of viability for that seed to germinate and grow is quite short. That's my thought of it. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it sounds plausible. And certainly it's what we've found, that seeds gathered from plants grow much better than seeds in seed packets. because their viability is greater.
So if we go down the tables you have set up here, what's ready to leave? Well, or what needs some time yet here too?
What's ready to leave is that already out there at the front and has already gone, because once it's gone into flower, it usually goes like hot cakes and then it's gone.
Okay.
So this year what we've sold mostly has been purple Viper's Bugloss, which is a bit more unusual than the common Viper's Bugloss. Last year we sold a lot of purple Loose Strife when it was in flower. We've sold Fox and Cubs will be quite popular, I imagine, once it comes into flower, because it's an unusual colour, bright orange. Foxglove's always popular, even though they're poisonous. People know them and they think, oh yes, I like foxgloves. Reminds them of their childhood or whatever. Forget-me-nots, the same thing. What else have we got? Some of these things are kind of experimental, really. And the Argentinian verbena is popular because people recognise that. I mean, I've got a load of bluebells under here, but they're a 2-year growing cycle at least, so it's a long time before they formed a bulb.
Wow.
But once they, I thought I'd give them a go from seed. We've got St. John's wort, that's a good medicinal one. Betony, that's a popular one. That's got a nice little flower head on it. Rest harrow, hedge crane's bill. What else have we got? Vervain, used to keep away witches, the English version of Verbena bonariensis. Very different looking plant though in some ways. Similar flower. Purple malva. That's about it really.
Is the consideration for where you plant, if the general public comes in and they buy their potted plants or their, well, that's different.
The plugs are for the National Trust. They're for putting in the wild.
You also sell the seeds, do you?
No.
No, only the, okay. No. But if they come in, if they come in and they're from Redruth or they're from further east, can these be easily planted there and, for lack of terminology, work? Or do they have to stick within the region?
Well, generally, Britain's a small island, isn't it? And things grow all over it. But there is, you'll be pleased to know, a huge book which was recently published about the flora of Cornwall and the West, Southwest. And it gives us maps for data for the last 20 years. And it's a beautiful book in its own right. Is it Colin French? I'm not sure. Anyway, so we can look in that and we can see that we can justify some of the things we grow. We can say, yes, but look, there's a patch there and a patch here.
Oh.
And the lines aren't sharp as to where something will grow and where it stops being favoured by that climate. But there are some sort of boundaries. Some of these plants wouldn't grow up in the Midlands, perhaps. And mostly that's because we've got a bit of an acidic granite rocks kind of soil here.
Mm-hmm.
The cliff tops particularly are a particular kind of environment. It's often quite peaty, the moorland soil. And some of the wildflowers like limey soils, and they won't grow here, really. We don't really seem to have limey calcareous soils. Is it calcium?
Calcerific.
Calcerific. Oh, we just invented a new word, which we do all the time. Yeah, so we can try different things. But as I say, I'm trying Devil's Bit Scabious, even though it doesn't really like, it likes a clayish, loamy soil, which it doesn't get much down here. I'm trying it because I really would like to see the marsh fritillary come back. And if I can really get some Devil's Bit Scabious going, that would be a great thing. I mean, obviously, if somebody plants it in their garden and it seeds and it spreads like that, so there you go.
Sorry, what do you mean marsh? You said marsh?
The marsh fritillary.
Okay,
it's
marsh
an extinct
fritillary.
Yeah, it's become a bit of a symbol for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a young boy, I used to collect butterflies, I'm ashamed to say.
Okay.
I've sort of atoned for them for years.
Ah.
I feel, getting a bit into my personal stuff. There's something rather peculiar about Devil's Bit. It's the derived from Devil's Bite, of course. devil's bite, I imagine. And the saying is that it got its name because if you pull it up, try and pull it up by the roots, it always leaves the bottom third of the root in the ground.
Ah, okay.
And the devil has his bite. So the devil's down there waiting for you to try and pull on his scabious.
Earlier on, you mentioned that the program has two prongs. Am I correct?
Yes.
Would you like to maybe unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I can keep it very simple. The one is to, apart from the well-being of our workers and so on, the one is to sell and wildflowers to gardeners, local gardeners, who might have particularly a damp patch or a shady patch or a difficult patch that doesn't favour nursery plants. And that creates corridors for wildlife in and through urban areas so they can forage over a greater range and they've got more chance of surviving climate change particularly, which forces them to move. So that's one prong. And the other one is, we produce plants in 9 centimetre diameter pots for them, which is a sort of industry standard. Mm-hmm. It's a small pot, you can see.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the National Trust at the moment is our only customer, which is producing wildflower plugs, very specific species for specific endangered insects. And they can be planted more easily. Somebody can carry a tray of 70 plants and plant them into the existing existing greenery and so on,
right.
Whether that's heathland or whatever.
Okay.
So that's a traditional way of enriching kind of agricultural land and so on.
Okay.
By increasing the biodiversity of the plants. I mean, the particular example that Ash gave was the longhorn minor bees,
mm-hmm.
and I'm quite interested in those.
Both prongs, though, am I correct? I mean, one of the main intentions is to build a network.
What sort of network?
What you were talking about between so that the bees, the butterflies, whatever, can go from
a physical network.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Right. So this is where I get confused when I look around and I see sort of in the meadow here and along the highways and along perhaps country roads or lanes where everything is sort of left to grow. And you have all sorts of different colors, I'll just say, of flowers in there.
It's beautiful around here, isn't it? Yeah.
Is that wildflower also that's growing there? Or is that something that's come in and taken over in parts? Or it looks like there is a natural corridor in places that I see, but I'm going with this question.
Yeah,
I'm trying to
that.
Understand the idea of network and corridor.
Right, well, you might have to talk to an ecologist, but hedgerows definitely act as corridors, and we've got a lot of wildflowers at the moment, sheepspit, red campion, hawk's beard, and so on. But they grow so well because they grow often in the Cornish hedges, which are very low in fertility and low in water supply and so on. So they're favoured because they can survive those conditions, whereas the kind of agricultural grass and nettles and docks and stuff need better soil. So they are definitely wildflower corridors. But a bee I don't know how far a bee can fly, maybe, I don't know, how far does a bee fly before it runs out of energy? Hopefully it'll find, one of the things we sell,
mm-hmm.
perhaps it'll clarify it, is we've got large black plastic potato buckets with handles, and we call them BOACs, and we grow a selection of wildflowers in the BOACs, and we sell those for 12 quid each, and you can move them around your patio, or
that's a neat idea.
They're relatively drought tolerant because they're wildflowers and they're used to growing in things like hedges and rockeries, and hopefully if people plant these flowers in their gardens, that will, in a sense, create a more permanent bee oasis. And the bee doesn't necessarily need a corridor then. If it can cover half a mile on its batteries or its energy, then it can reach an oasis and it can continue and leapfrog into other places. This is Joss, who's done quite a lot of work with the Wildflower Project.
Oh, Joss, do you want to come over and have a word? Or are you on your way out? You've got your bicycle. We can have a chat.
Yeah.
So we have Joss here, who's a, maybe give us a little bit of your background or how you're involved with the Wildflower Project.
I met Nick on a recording group session. Nick suggested a wildflower garden would be great, and so we volunteered to help him.
Right.
And that was last year, wasn't it, Nick?
That was the PLP-funded ecology surveying group, ecological surveying group, recording group, yeah.
And what brought you, what's your specialty here?
I'm learning from Nick.
Oh. Yeah, I'm learning as I go along.
On a good day, what's the total number of people that are giving you a hand out here?
Well, we generally do a Wednesday morning at the moment, and although there are quite a few people involved with the project peripherally, sometimes I have to say it is just me. Joss puts in a lot of hours. There are three or four people altogether who kind of pitch in, but we're limited by the size of the staging in the polytunnel, by the price of the compost, and you know, there's a sort of sweet spot where we can sell everything we grow. If we go anything beyond that, then we end up with spending too much money on compost,
right?
Particularly.
Okay, and Joss, what do you get out of the project personally?
Well, I've got a garden full of wonderful wildflowers. Honestly,
right.
It's full of bees, and it's just fantastic. And they're so beautiful. I couldn't tell you how wonderful they look. And that's just from a year's planting.
So you've seen a significant difference.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Wow.
So I'd advocate everybody to have a wildflower garden. Yeah, we've been going out. Me and Kate, we went to a plant sale and trying to spread them about.
Right. Can you just describe briefly, like, if someone was to come into your I'll just call it your patch,
uh-huh,
for the garden, what would they see? Because wildflower garden to some people means everything just basically just grows. You don't cut the grass. Some people leave an area that's manicured and then a patch that isn't. How do you keep yours?
I've got a bed, and I've got betony, purple, viper's blue gloss, and an array of just fabulous colours, and aquilegia, all sorts, mallow, huge mallow tree, but all from last year, and foxgloves, yeah, honestly, it's beautiful, really beautiful.
That sounds amazing. Great. Oh, well, thank you very much. I know you were on your way out. Okay, see you.
Thanks, Joss.
I didn't ask you about yours, your home.
Well, we've got a roof garden, which is the back of the kitchen roof. It's basically large pots, probably about at least 20 of them. And we grow a mixture of things in there. And there's wildflowers in most of them. But my partner does that bit of the gardening. Because
right.
I tend to...
You're here.
I'm here, exactly. And I mean, I do have a bit of a horticultural background. I did a year at Pershore Horticultural College when I was just married and my kids were very small, and I needed to get a job, basically. And there was a lot of gardening work around in the hometown that I grew up in, a lot of elderly people, particularly with big gardens. And I loved it. I got right into it, and I wouldn't describe myself as an expert, but I'm quite experienced in a practical kind of way.
What level do I need to enter into venturing into this way of gardening? Do you have any advice in terms of getting started, what you need? You mentioned earlier about just simply one flower already contributes.
Yes, I mean, I suppose there are two ways of doing it. One would be to buy some wildflowers off us and get some free advice. And that would include taking account of the conditions, possibly soil conditions and the aspect, the direction that the sun's coming from, whether it's south-facing or north-facing. We've got one or two books, and there are lots of books on the market or even secondhand in bookstalls that help you describe different kinds of wildflowers. The one that I talked about before is particularly useful for us because it has the distributions of wildflowers, so it doesn't just identify them, it helps you decide which ones might be right for the area. The other thing, of course, you can do is buy the seed. As I said before, I think people sometimes give up because the seed is often of very limited viability, not because the seed manufacturer has done anything wrong, but because the wildflowers themselves, that is their strategy, produce right. loads and loads of seed with limited viability and hope that some of it gets into the right place. Mm-hmm. But you can certainly try that, and some are better
Sorry,
than others.
Is that considered a shotgun approach then?
Yeah, that's a good description of it, I would say. You know, you can certainly have a go with it, and some things do come up very easily. There are certain things that over the time we're getting more experience as to what is worth growing and what isn't. Because most of the nectar producing plants, that any insect that can reach that nectar that's got a long enough tongue, whether it's a bee or a butterfly or whatever, will benefit from that. So that's the immediate thing, is giving them nectar, which provides them with energy. But then the other thing, of course, is specific plants for very specific creatures. And that's more into the realm of the National Trust biodiversity drive. So yes, and if you go to the garden centre, you can choose plants that are garden plants, but are actually pretty much wild flowers. I mean, certainly you can buy scabious, devil spit scabious, or small scabious, or field scabious, that has there's a particular cultivar. I can't remember what the scabious plant I saw the other day was in a nursery. It was something like Blue Danube or something. It was a particular name that mm-hmm. cultivar had, and you know they choose particular plants in nurseries that grow especially big flowers and so on. So you can be selective about the plants you buy from a garden centre and choose ones that produce pollen, that produce nectar, because otherwise they're a waste of time as far as the insects are concerned, and that may even be a food plant for a caterpillar. I mean, you know, we all curse when caterpillars eat our favourite border plants, but at the same time, you know, we like to see the butterflies as well, so mm-hmm. we can't have it both ways, you know. Nettles are a fantastic food plant for small tortoiseshell, red admiral, peacock butterflies. But, you know, I guess there's probably enough of those in the world. Mm. But there are other plants, I mean, that people consider as weeds, which if you leave them, I'm thinking purple toad flax, for instance, just a little weed in the walls and stuff. But you leave it and it produces flower spikes, you know, with lovely, beautiful purple flowers.
Do you think that there is a scope for garden consultant or a strategist if somebody's really stuck and they don't know? The best thing is just to go to a garden center or come and get some advice.
Well, a garden center probably won't know much about wildflowers and ecology, the particular ecology of the area that they're in necessarily. Sometimes they will. There are some notable exceptions. The best thing is to get a plant list probably from somebody that knows. I mean, we're happy to give advice, and even if you just start with one species, you know, one packet of seed, you can grow them in egg boxes. They're great. They're a bit like a plug, and you can plant the egg box. If you cut it up when they've grown, you can plant the cardboard bit of the egg box with the plant, mm-hmm. and it rots away, and you've got a little production line going.
I guess my analogy, or what I'm looking at, is if you're looking at human food, right, you can either eat junk food or food that's going to give you energy and keep you healthy or help you sleep better or think better or be more refreshed. Could that same application apply to if you've got wildflowers, you're providing the insects and butterflies with a proper nutrition versus something that has less nutrition?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the difference with flowers is you've either got zero nutrition.
Okay.
Because a lot of flowers that are bred to be, for instance, double petaled, in the process of being bred to be double petaled, they lose their anthers and the stamens, their seed producing and nectar producing parts. So they are just a pom-pom on the end of a branch. Right. They have absolutely no value apart from as compost, you know.
Right.
So I wouldn't even analyze it in terms of good or bad. It's just, you know, nectar is essentially sugar in more sugary water, you know. But as I said, there are some species that need particular proteins, particular plants for constructing particular things that they, you know, parts of their body or houses or whatever.
I guess following on with that question, if you have a garden of flowers that aren't really nectar producing, can that fool sort of nature to come in and then they waste their energy looking for something in a garden like that? Whereas if you had a garden that was full of wildflowers, they would be getting energy straight away.
Yeah, that's quite perceptive, I think, because the flower is an attractant. The flower is designed, if you like, it's evolved by nature to attract insects in order to pollinate the plant. So obviously brightly coloured flowers are attractive to insects, but then they get frustrated and there's no pollen or nectar in them necessarily. Or their tongues aren't long enough, or their bodies don't quite fit in the right way. I mean, you know, they've evolved over millions of years to fit a particular plant. I mean, we've only been here a few million years, human beings, possibly not even that. I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that it's a blink of an eye compared to plants and insects. Right. And if the insects go, the birds go, and the reptiles go, and everything goes. You know, the insects are the key level of the food pyramid. I mean, you've got plants and fungi and bacteria and stuff on the bottom, and they feed insects or insect-like creatures, and everything else eats it. Even blue whales live on basically sea insects.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to sort of tell me that's not true, but in my mind's eye, I think of plankton or krill, it's called, isn't it? You know, big things eat little things.
Mm-hmm.
Without the little things, we don't get the big things, and we're big things.
Mm.
So, I mean, it is self, in our self-interest to make sure that there is the minimum level of structure and network and whatever to support the insect population. And it is getting scary, but, you know, don't get scared. Do something positive.
Right. Which leads me on to maybe a question I have about the future with your project. This is the second year, correct, you said?
Yes.
Okay. If we're looking, say, to the five-year marker, what is it you hope to achieve?
Well, I'd like a lot more people to be growing wildflowers. I think we've had a tough year this year with the cold temperature. It really does affect things, the temperature. So I guess it would be nice to have a bit more expertise ourselves and be able to use that expertise. I'd like to see things like the in bloom kind of competition and stuff, encourage wildflowers. I'd like schools to encourage wildflowers. I know a lot of them already do. I'd like us to be a kind of a seed in ourselves, to sort of seed that idea and really help it to spread, so that it becomes really like smoking in public or whatever. You know, it becomes a bit of an antisocial thing to grow garden flowers, as opposed to wildflowers. And as I said before, you know, mental health is important, beauty is important. And we respond to flowers in much the same way I imagine that a bee does in some ways. But there's no reason we can't have beauty. You heard Joss, because there's no reason we can't have a beautiful border full of wildflowers and scents. You know, wildflowers have a scent, which of course sometimes isn't true of highly bred garden varieties. And you can have it all. You can have the beauty, you can have this, the be part of the ecological network, the jigsaw, and help be positively inspired in terms of your mental health because you're doing something, you know.
Can we just Can we just look at the mental health aspect? Can you just expand on that part a bit?
Well, I've come across a lot of people who go into kind of panic mode about things like climate change. And I think biodiversity loss is an even more important one in some ways. We can adapt to climate change. I don't think we can adapt to biodiversity loss. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily helpful. It makes your guts churn, makes you ill, upsets your mental health, and it doesn't do anything positive in a way. I think just one practical act has a kind of diffusing effect somehow, I find, on my own mental state. You know, if I just do one thing, like I fill a pot with compost, I stick my hands in the compost, I fill a pot with compost, and I put a seed in it, and I water it, and I watch it grow, and then it flowers, and there's a couple of bees on it, and I think, oh, that's a hairy-footed flower bee, not a usual bumblebee, or something like that, because I've looked in the book. So you can get apps that identify things. You can get apps for your phone for flower identification. You can just point it at a flower and on your walk and learn some of the names of the flowers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I find that helps my mental health. I think translating worry into action, even if it's a very small action, is a very effective strategy for dealing with stress and worry.
We're not talking about that you need, you know, even a piece of land. You can do this simply potting a balcony or a small space, you know, outside your windows. Would you say that's sufficient enough?
Well, it's if that's what you've got, that's what you do. I mean, as I say, we've got a little roof garden. We don't have a real garden much. And we have these kind of BOA seeds that we've sold a few of this year, with a sort of bunch of wildflowers in a movable pot. So you could use what you like.
Are they around?
Yeah,
here?
they're just over here at the front.
Can we go take a peek at that? Okay, so we're in front of one of these BOA seeds.
Okay. I'm not sure about the name, but we haven't come up with a better one. But it's basically a potato bucket, which has got two handles on the top. I don't know how many litres it is, about 15 litres probably. And we plant half a dozen wildflowers that we've grown in pots. And then we leave it and water. And we end up with something like the other side of the door here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this is, you've got Viper's bugloss, which is the English echium. We're all familiar with Cornish echiums, the giant ones. They come from Madeira, I believe. Or is it? No, they're Canary Islands, the big echiums. Then we've got this is the Verbena bonari, the Argentinian verbena that I was talking about, that the hummingbird hawk moths like. That grows, that'll take over and that'll flower till November. That's why one of the reasons it's such a good plant for nectar-needing insects.
Sorry, the height of that was about a meter and a half?
Yeah, no. Oh, easily, yes. But it's a funny plant because it's just that thin stick with a purple pom-pom on the end. But it's got a sort of attraction because of that. We've got some more Viper's bugloss there. What else have we got in here? There's a sea campion growing as a sort of bottom layer. And a forget-me-not. And this is a bit of a rarity around these parts. This is purple Viper's bugloss. And what's that one? Fox and hounds. Fox and cubs. Betony. They're not in flower yet. So the idea is there's always something in flower. And you can see a little hoverfly going into the Viper's bugloss there. There's always something in flower between the spring and there's another bee coming in. And
they really are working, if that's the term. Anyway,
yeah,
it's really
they're
working.
They're great. They're an intense little, that's all they need really, is they just need something to cling on to. And it's like the longhorn minor bees on the coast the National Trust are so worried about. There's just one colony or so, as far as I understand it. It's very vulnerable. So if you can allow them the smallest handhold to get establish other colonies nearby, and they're not aggressive bees, they're rather cute. They've got very long feelers and tiny,
right.
That's why they're called longhorn
minor
bees.
What happens in the winter? All this dies back. And then does it come back in the spring, or would you get a new pot?
Well, the verbena is a perennial, so most of this is a perennial. We tend to choose perennials, so they'll come back year after year. The Viper's bugloss remains to be seen. I suspect it's a biennial mostly, maybe every 3 or 4 years. I mean, you can, if you're using a bee oasis, like a big pot or a tub or a planter, and the seeds are not going to go anywhere, and you don't want to gather the seeds yourself, you can deadhead the plant before it forms seeds. And this is true of foxgloves particularly. And that will extend its life up to sort of 7 years or so even. Mm-hmm. I've heard of foxgloves living that long. But you have to stop them from producing seed because they put all their energy into the seed and die.
Right. Okay.
Rather like us.
Okay. Right.
I mean, maybe not.
Is there anything inside the polytunnel that we could have a look at, or?
No, the polytunnel's emptied, but you can have a look at the area. I mean, we just use this left-hand side, and it's very warm in the polytunnel, and it's great in about February when we've sown the seed. We leave it outside in seed trays through the winter, the autumn grown sown seed, so it gets the cold, which breaks the dormancies to some degree. We bring it in February. The heat kickstarts it into germinating, and then we get it out there before in April. We get it out onto the outside staging so it doesn't get, because it literally will get cooked from April on in the polytunnel. Mm.
And does the project have a high season, low season, no season?
Well, we sow a lot of seeds in the spring and the autumn, and really the autumn sown seeds are probably more productive in terms of saleable plants. You know, it's been a funny year, and I guess I'm talking like a farmer now, because I've become aware of how even a bit of a delay in February can set everything back weeks.
Right.
You know, it's a cumulative delay, it seems. So we were about 3 weeks later in February with germination and stuff than we were last year. And last year we had mature plants to sell this time of year, even before. Mm. Whereas now, you know, most of our plants are quite small. But it all comes out in the wash. I mean, if we still got them in the autumn, we'll pot them into bigger pots, grow them on a bit, and charge twice as much.
Earlier,
we have to do that because of the compost. You know,
yeah, right. Earlier on, just in terms of the growing seasons, things that you are learning, what sort of things are you learning, or what lessons have you learnt to date that stick out?
Well, that's, I mean, I've got a fairly good grounding in soil science and that kind of thing. Botany, perhaps. Well, not so much botany, but there is no explanation for the way some plants grow and some don't, you know.
Right.
I mean, we're dealing with problems one at a time, and the big problem this year, last year was choosing the species of plants. That was our first year that would grow. This year it's slugs and snails.
Right.
And, you know, they've been eating a lot of our seedlings because of the damp weather, you know, so they can get in. In terms of learning, well, yeah, I don't know. I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
But I guess where I'm headed with that question is that anyone that's new to this, or you know, that there is to be expected that there's going to be a learning curve.
Yes, yeah, it's very, very much a learning curve, and it was quite a steep one last year. But the basic process is simple, and the plants want to live, the seeds want to grow. So, you know, they don't, and the longhorn bees want to survive, and all of these insects and plants want to thrive. And it's coded into their genes, coded into our genes. It doesn't take that much for them to do it. It just needs to be good enough. the soil just needs to be good enough. The planting technique just needs to be good enough. They only need just enough water. They don't need tons of attention, you know. So they help you. Nature will help you. If you want to grow stuff, you know, just put some compost, ideally compost, but even soil will do, you know, and have a go. And what I wouldn't do is grow seeds on blotting paper and separately and in water, in jugs of water and all this stuff, and then transplant them into soil and expect them to thrive, because that doesn't always really work.
Is that the paper towel method? You put a seed in between and then water it down?
Well, it's what we did at school with, you know, we stuck seeds in between paper towels. Yeah. It's not good for growing seeds that you want to put out in the garden, because they need a different kind of root system.
Mm.
What is surprising, though, is you can stick your seeds in a damp, poor soil in a seed tray in the winter, September, October and November, stick them out, forget about them, let the ice and the snow, well, we don't get so much snow down here, but let all the elements work on them, and that's what they like, that's what they want, and they'll all come up in the spring, if the snails don't and slugs don't get them. But you know, they don't need to be mollycoddled, particularly, especially wildflowers. I mean, one of the things that I found quite interesting was we have international woofers here, working volunteers, and we often get ones from France and Spain. And I was trying to explain to them what I was doing in the wildflower project, and they didn't have a phrase for wildflowers.
Really?
They had meadow flowers, wood flowers. They didn't have wildflowers, and they said, well, if we did have a phrase for wildflowers, it would be les fleurs sauvages, the savage flowers. And I thought that's rather nice, you know. They're fighting for survival, you know, they give it all it's got. They just need a bit of a helping hand. And the same's true, I think, of the insects and so on. So
it really sounds like there's obviously a built-in tenacity that's there.
Yes, that's the word.
So the babysitting method of the old ways we learned in school doesn't build that tenacity in. It makes them a bit weak.
Well, you can draw all sorts of analogies, can't you, with human society, I'm sure, as well.
Sure.
But yes, I think, you know, the idea of wildflowers is a bit sort of dainty. It's got a sort of Victorian hangover of the kind of, you know, the colonial explorer bringing about rare orchids, or some lady painting with watercolours in her back garden. You know, the truth is that wildflowers are the bottom layer of the food pyramid. They provide the food materials, nesting materials, undergrowth structure, pollen, nectar for everything else.
This question has popped into my mind. Is there a danger of wildflowers becoming, if they're picked up and marketed more on the mainstream, if it was to take off in that direction? Is there, because this is a grassroots sort of project, a grassroots area. Is there a grassroots farm? Is there would there be an opportunity for these for wildflowers to actually be industrialized in some sort of way?
Well, they are. I mean, they're used sometimes by farmers locally who, actually, many of them, some of them care about wildflowers and ecology, some of them don't. But even the ones that don't grow them as a green manure or to encourage soil structure and stuff. So you do see purple fields at certain times of year.
Right.
And those are, I think, is it Phacelia or something like that? I'm sorry, my memory for names is not good, partly because of the Parkinson's and stuff. But they are rather like the Viper's bugloss. They've got the blue, intense blue flowers. And you see a lot of oxeye daisies on the traffic islands and things. Now they're perennials, of course. So, I mean, they're perhaps a bit overused. I mean, there's a danger possibly of wildflower species, certain species becoming favourites. And then, you know, you don't gain much in terms of biodiversity. I mean, that's the one thing I have learned is that apart from every flea has fleas, smaller fleas living on it. Apart from that, the other thing is that it's not always the most spectacular, attractive beetles and flowers and so on that that are the most important ones. You know, from the view of ecology and keeping the ecology vibrant and importantly to it supports farming as much. A lot of farmers are finding biodiversity increasing techniques that support their farming. You know, of course, because it creates more resistance to disease, a wider genetic range, and so on and so on. But I think I would worry about monocultures of oxeye daisies and so on. Depends, if you're gathering seed, there's a couple of very important things. One is you should never take more than a third of the seeds that plant is producing, because that's the animal's winter food store. And you're basically stealing their winter food. So don't take more than you need. You don't need many. One foxglove flower will produce thousands and thousands of seeds. You know, more than enough. And the other thing that is important is
don't take lots of seeds.
Yes, the other thing that's important is taking a few seeds from one plant, taking a few seeds from another plant, a few seeds from another plant in a variety of conditions, because that way you get a more genetically diverse bunch of seeds. And a more genetically diverse bunch of plants. And I suppose right down at the bottom of it all, in my very depths, that is what I have is that I have a strong emotional response to biodiversity loss when I see the Amazon burning, or when I see the fields being sprayed or whatever. I have a strong emotional reaction to it, and it is rather like watching a library burn or something. It's kind of the loss of genetic information. I mean, as daft as it sounds, you know, there are animals that, for instance, produce light, like glowworms, and things. So they presumably have got a sort of genetic makeup, genetic blueprints, genetic precursors for that, and so on. And if they became extinct, not only would they have become extinct, and anything that depends on them for food and so on become extinct, but we would have lost the gene for glowing in the dark animals. And who knows, you know, we might need that gene at some point down the road. If not necessarily to allow us to glow in the dark, but it could happen. But for medicine or stuff, you know, modern medicine techniques, production techniques, rely on genetic engineering and so on. And that's what they do. They splice genes. They say, there's a great technique for seeing what's going on in the human brain. And I forgot what it's called, but basically they splice glowworm genes into something. Okay. And it lights up when it fires a nerve cell.
Yeah.
What's it called? Something, neurooptics or something.
Okay.
It's a new science. They're all writing about it. And, you know, that is a gene out of a glowworm or something. So, you know, if we lose genetic code, it's like we're all part of this, we're all on the same ark, the same lifeboat. And if we lose genetic code, we've shrunk our available response to whatever is ahead. So biodiversity loss is an important thing to try and prevent, really. For me, it's an emotional response. As I say, if somebody was burning all the works of Charles Dickens and there were no replacements, I'd be pretty upset.
Is that where you would like to leave your final word, or do you have a final word for our listeners?
I think I'm disappearing down a rabbit hole or two. So it is something I do. So probably this is why I think my final word is do something, even if it's something very small. You know, this is it. It grounds me to do something. It puts me in touch with the real world as opposed to the world in one's head. And that's where I'd leave it, really. Just even if it's very small, just plant something.
Right. Well, Nick, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that concludes part one of episode 3, Go Wild, Planting Wildflowers to Encourage Biodiversity. Part 2 features Ash Pearson from the National Trust outlining why and how they use the wildflowers grown by Nick Hall's team for specific needs. If you have any questions or concerns or comments about this episode, please see our disclaimer at www.bazavarancommunityfarm.org.uk. The Twist and Sprout podcast is a production of themangolab.com.